Hello, it's Michael Cathcart here from Books and Arts, where my favourite interview was my talk with the Libyan writer Hisham Mattar. Now, Hisham was just 19 when his father, a leading Libyan dissident named Jabalah Mattar, was abducted from the family's home in exile in Cairo. Jabalah had incurred the murderous wrath of the Libyan dictator Colonel Gaddafi, and he was taken to a brutal prison in Libya called Abu Salim, where it now seems he was killed 6 years later. But Hisham didn't know for sure if his father was dead, and that uncertainty has gnawed away at him for 20 years. So here he is, Hisham Mattar himself, to talk about his powerful and candid new book, The Return. It's Hisham's own true story of his battle to find out what really happened to his father. Hisham, it's nice to be talking to you again.
Thank you for having me.
So you were born in New York City in 1970, where your father was working for the Libyan mission in the UN. And then when you were just three, you returned to Gaddafi's Libya. And then in 1979, your family fled to Cairo. Why did you have to leave?
Well, you know, some political historians refer to that time as the second revolution or the second coup, where the Gaddafi regime exhausted the goodwill of the people and the optimism that surrounded this new young republican age. And it started doing what most dictatorships have to do at certain intervals, find new enemies, excite new fervor of its supporters. And so lots of people in the late 1970s in Libya were imprisoned, people such as writers and lawyers, and it was a very grim time within the four decades of Gaddafi's rule. And so my parents decided to leave. Or actually my mother decided to leave. My father had reservations because he didn't want to leave his country. And my mother was really the one that led the ship out of the harbor. And we went to Egypt, and it took a while for my father to join us, and we started a new life there.
There are certainly people in your book who see your father as a hero, and you can understand why. I mean, this is a man who can write in a letter home from prison, smuggled out from prison, the line, "My forehead does not know how to bow." So how did you learn that he had disappeared?
I was in London then. I was attending university, and for some peculiar reason, I don't know, maybe over earnestness, I sort of would time my lectures to be first thing in the morning, so I'm done very early. So I went to my early morning lecture and met someone there, another student whose father knew my father. And he sort of did a double take when he saw me walk into the main building. You know, said, "You know, are you well?" I said, "Yeah, I'm fine." "What?" He said, "Are you sure? Is everything okay?" I said, "Yeah, absolutely." And that was it. And I just felt something wasn't right, so I went back home and called my mother and found out that my father had been arrested that morning. And from that moment on, everything in my life was overshadowed by this fact. Mm-hmm. And my 20s, you know, in the idealized vision of youth, the 20s are the moment of playful exploration and, you know, outrageous behavior. Mine were very interior, because we were locked in this fate. We couldn't speak about it because we thought that would risk his safety.
We should say, Hisham, that your father was a genuine threat to Gaddafi. This is not just about suppressing dissent. He had spent his fortune, which you say was over $6 million. He'd been a very successful businessman, you explain. He'd spent all this money on a plan to overthrow the government.
Yes, my father was very effective. You know, he had lots of skills that made him dangerous. He was dangerous to Gaddafi. He was a good organizer, a military man with some diplomatic experience. He had a wide network of contacts, and he knew how to lead men. He was definitely a dangerous opponent.
So he ends up in this prison, this notorious prison, Abu Salim, and you tell an extraordinary story about how other members of your family were already there in the prison. And at first, they refused to recognize Jabalah when he arrived, even though he was in a cell adjacent to where they were already incarcerated. What was going on there? Why couldn't they recognize the fact that this man who was so revered within the family was now among them?
In the early days of their incarceration, they were my relatives, my two uncles and two cousins, who were all arrested on the same day. and interrogated, and then eventually, you know, they end up in Abu Sleem prison. And slowly, they, within this peculiar world of the prison where you're relying a lot on what you hear and the various voices and sounds around you, they learn of each other's presence there. But it was the furthest thing from their minds that my father was there too, because my father was not in Libya like them. They were arrested from inside the country. And so they thought he was safe. So my father then, for reasons I don't know and reasons that I think about and try to investigate in the book, he doesn't let on that he's there to immediately. He does it, you know, in sort of in stages. He would speak out and say to his brother Mahmoud, "Hello, Mahmoud, do you recognize me?" And then my uncle wouldn't recognize him. And there'll be another week of silence before my father would speak again, and so on. So there was this kind of watery world of the prison where you're not entirely sure of perceptions and so on. And this is all something that has preoccupied me for a long time. Why did my uncle not recognize my father? And the reason I think about these things, I think, is because if you look at the various things that have happened to somebody like me, where you're forced to leave your country, then you lose your father in this way, you lose relatives that are basically removed from the world for two decades in political prisons, other friends, people I don't even mention in the book. If you go through this, one of the feelings that you feel is a feeling of submergence, you know, as if history were grabbing you by the neck and drowning you. So one of the things that is going on in the book is an attempt to do almost the opposite, to bring all of these things to the surface and think about them in as calm and creative way as possible in order to not drown.
On the 29th of June in 1996, Gaddafi's people gunned down 1,270 prisoners in the courtyard of that prison. And you say, since it does seem that he was killed at some stage by the regime, you say that you hope at least that it was on that day that he died. Why do you hope that?
Well, if I think of all of the possible ways that my father was killed, one of the horrors is that your imagination is forever ticking away at the possible things that might have happened because you don't have an exact story. And it's actually the genius of international law, that international law deems disappearance as equal to torture, not only to the person who's been made to disappear, but also to the family of the person who's been made to disappear. And I think that's actually a very accurate reading of it. I cannot tell you the amount of things that I've imagined that might have happened to my father. And one of the less miserable imaginings is of him with others, not in solitude, not, you know, subjected to some endless brutal torture, but dying with other men around him. Partly because I know he would be good. I don't even think it or imagine it. I know he would be good with others. His instinct to comfort them and to help them would step in. So, you know, it's in that context that I mention that.
So you go back to Libya after the regime fell, the Gaddafi regime fell in 2011. You go back to Libya, and your return to Libya is really the meat of this book. What are you looking for?
That's a very good question, because I myself didn't know. I was filled with a jumble of burning curiosities, and I was very confused, and I was frightened, and I couldn't explain why I was confused or frightened. In retrospect, I think what I was looking for is a vibrant, new, contemporary relationship with my country. A relationship that isn't, in other words, informed by what happened in the past, but a relationship that is like all the wonderful relationships we seek, either with people or with places, a relationship that is in the present, that isn't forever responding to the past.
You come face to face with the past early on in your return to Libya, because you're taken to a ransacked library to give a reading. It's the shell of a library. Perhaps you could tell us about this event, because I suppose the first question is, who are the people who wanted to hear from you? Because as you tell the story, your work had been suppressed by the government, your name couldn't be published in the press, and yet there was an audience for your work. Who were these people?
Well, you know, there were writers, there were people who knew my father from my father's generation, who knew him when we, you know, when they grew up together, they worked together, they were in the army together, or they taught together. And so they represented different sides to my father, some of which I knew nothing about. I didn't know, for example, that my father, when he was 18, edited a literary journal and published a couple of short stories. I had no idea about that.
It's a beautiful moment when you describe this old man handing you this book, which is the student magazine that he and your father had edited. And you actually, in the second half of this gathering, read your own father's stories to these people.
It was a very long event. It went on for a long time. It was so long, in fact, that there had to be an intermission. So after the intermission, we thought we'll open it with a reading from one of my father's short stories. The book is obviously called The Return. On some level, it's interested in the attempt to return anywhere, because I think maybe we can never return anywhere. Whenever we go back somewhere, we are actually going to a new place. We discover new things. And the things that I discovered different sides of, new sides of my father, of my mother too. Things I didn't know about my mother that I discovered in that event, when a man stood up at the end and told this incredibly powerful story about my mother's activism, which she actually forgot. My mother didn't remember that she had this reputation in the country of housing the mothers of young political prisoners who would come to Tripoli to visit their sons, and she would give them safe refuge.
You write this, whereas my father was obsessed with the past and the future, with returning to and remaking Libya, my mother was devoted to the present. Can you talk some more about that quality in your mother and what place she holds in the story of your own life and the creation of you?
Absolutely. It's really my mother who, to me, is the most radical figure in my life. Radical in the true sense of the word, you know, that reaching to the roots. Somebody who was deeply invested in her gestures and the way that she thought, the way she cooked, the way she talked about stories and literature throughout those years, but also, thankfully, until today, and may it long last, a kind of, you know, vibrant engagement with reality and life and joy. And that's something that's very hard to teach anyone. You just have to show them it, you know. You can't teach your child to have an ardent enthusiasm for the light, for joy, for life, for living, that life is for the living.
Hisham Mattar. He's been talking about his book, The Return, a true story published by Viking. I'm Michael Cathcart, and you can join me 10 a.m. weekdays for Books and Arts, or podcast the show anytime you like.